So I want to talk about hydrodynamic blow-up, and I think we can answer the question quite quickly here, what does it have to do with turbulence? Obviously, you know, blow-up has a lot to do with, it is one of the ingredients in statistical theories and intermittency and all that, and you know, the open problem of global regularity is effectively hydrodynamic blow-up. I like to think of it, I mean, if something is going to blow up in incompressible, inviscid flow, or Navier-Stokes flow, there it has to be in the form of a wavelength and frequency blow-up. I mean, that you have to have something, basically the vorticity going to infinity, which can be interpreted as a frequency blow-up, and then it has to occur in an ever-shrinking region of space. And so, and this has to happen in a finite time, so it's sort of an ultimate cascade. It's going to be a strange beast. I'll show you a little bit of some flows that I feel are suspicious. They may actually end in blow-up, but of course you can't compute a blow-up. Computing a blow-up is an oxymoron, so it can only kind of point you in certain directions for further analysis. I'll try to convince you that you know, you have this image of a vortex stretching itself or something, you know, and being pulled out, you know, and the core going to zero. It's very difficult to get something to stretch itself, which is really needed. But I've been seeing in my flow that it's really caused by images, and then the collapse of these images with the fundamental getting closer and closer together. This is probably the main reason why I don't think at least these suspect flows will never happen in turbulence. Because you really have to do, in fact, I have to assume a cubic symmetry, which I'll define in a minute. And so there are basically too many symmetries, and you'll never see this flow in turbulence. And even if you do see the flow, I haven't checked it, but I'm pretty sure that it's unstable to symmetry breaking perturbations. And so the answer is it doesn't have very much to do with turbulence, at least what I'm pursuing. And so anybody who wants to go can. But let me put up one more slide, and that might pique your interest in this. Everyone probably knows about this. But forgetting about turbulence for a minute, there's the Hilbert tube. So here are the problems we're supposed to be working on. Of course, Navier-Stokes, the global regularity problem in Navier-Stokes is there. And then this is the little blurb. And then this is taken as the problem. Basically, you have to either show that the Navier-Stokes equations exist and are smooth in all initial conditions, and all R3 are in a periodic domain, or they break down in all R3 or for a periodic domain. And so that's, and then we can, it's $1 million, right?
What's the difference between the
initial gas,
AB, and CD?
Just in R3 or in a periodic.
Okay.
So it's just it's the same statement only in a periodic domain. And then this is just, that I think this is probably easier to show a flow will break down rather than all flows will not break down. So I think,
I didn't see it. Is there forcing or no forcing?
Let's see. F is the force. Yeah, here.
Oh, okay.
F zero.
Oh, zero, okay. No
right. So, and let's see if it's the
you
other one.
You can have F in the C.
Yeah, you can't have F there, but it has, there are constraints on it. Okay, you can't. Right. I mean, really just discuss this the whole thing. Yeah. Okay. I don't think...
Well, do they give half a million for half a proof?
They give half a million for oil.
No, they give nothing for oil. No. Nothing. So, I think I'll apply to go on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
We have a photo ballot to see what people believe.
Proof by democracy. Yeah. Right. Well, I think most of you are familiar with this, these things. Let me just jump right into the flows in which I see blow-up possibly happening. And this is what started it all off. This is a pseudo-spectral simulation. I think we did 1,200 cubed or something. Oh, well, with symmetry, I think it was 300 cubed or something. But this is isovorticity, and I should explain the symmetries here. Each of the zero planes are mirrors. So you have reflectional symmetry, three reflectional symmetries. Anyone familiar with the Taylor-Green vortex? Okay, so it's like that, only more. Taylor-Green has the three symmetries. Now, if you come out the diagonal and assume that you come out to the vertex of a cube, there's a threefold symmetry there. From the zero through the diagonal, you have a threefold symmetry that you preserve. So the flow has a threefold symmetry to begin with. It's okay, right? The Navier-Stokes allows this. Okay, so I was running with that, and I was trying to do turbulent simulations, and this thing came out from a low mode initial condition, and it's basically dipoles that are all coming into the origin, and this is an early time low isosurface of vorticity, later time higher isosurface. I just moved the one over. I mean, it actually collapses in there. So I said, well, what's all this? So that's where I start. But if you look at the times there, and then compare, and look at the analyticity strip. Is anyone familiar with that? If you track the exponential part, the coefficient on the in the exponential of the power spectrum, and basically when you're well resolved, this thing is greater than the grid size. Okay, and so it's about a severe constraint, but you can see, even with 1200 cubed at time 1.3, even before these pictures were on there, you can't trust it. And so maybe those pictures are nice, but you certainly can't do any analysis on this thing. It can only kind of say, hey, maybe this is a direction for further analysis. So, it's a good thing. When everyone claims singularity, ask them to show this. And then don't believe anything that has in their analyticity strip is below the grid size. Okay? All right. So we did that, and I couldn't take it any further. I mean, so what we did is a time series, an extended series, where you assume a power series expansion for velocity, and then you stick that into the Navier-Stokes equation, and you basically get term by term an expansion based on the earlier terms. And so you can turn the crank and let with high precision and all, and look at entropy. If you look at entropy, here's a few terms of the entropy series. I think we went out to 36 terms, so entropy is an even function, so you only get 18 terms of the entropy, and you can see that in fact it's diverging, but it's diverging in an alternating way, and so there's an imaginary singularity, but if you use Pade, you can get around that. And so finally, you get something like this. This is the plot of poles, the dark symbols are poles, done by Pade analysis of that expansion in complex time. So, and every time that every possible Pade that I do on it gives you a singularity at about 2. So there's a basically a simple pole sitting out there. So that was more evidence. That was rather unphysical evidence, but if we didn't get it, then we would start worrying. So
there were no poles off the axis?
There were lots of poles off the axis. That's reason. I mean, and they were closer than two. That's why you had to use pod A, because the Taylor series swooped out after a radius of this. So, so you know, this is rather old stuff, and I can give you the results.
Why aren't they actually curves? I mean, couldn't you expect they were curves? There may be a real time. There may be the same singularity, maybe somewhere else in the complex plane. Why is that not the case?
Say that again?
I would have expected that at any given time you may have singularity somewhere in the complex plane.
Right.
Which is then traveling.
Traveling. No, I mean this. I mean entropy is just think of it as a time series. It's just a straight Taylor series in time. Okay, and it has a singularity structure, and you can find it through pod A analysis. Perhaps you're worrying about maybe mixing space and time in this. Well, we've taken space out completely by doing the averaging and looking just at the entropy.
And what does this mean?
Defect is when you have a zero in the denominator and a zero in the numerator that are very close together. They should be canceling out, but because of slight errors, they don't.
And then what is that?
That's pod A. That's a polynomial in the numerator, the order of the polynomial in the numerator, and the order of polynomial in the denominator. So, you expect defects. They pop in and pop out as time goes on. Or as the expansion is higher. So I didn't want to spend too much. All I want to say is that that analysis gave more evidence that there was a blow up.
And the position of singularity is a function of initial conditions? Somehow movable singularity?
Well, our initial condition was only three. I don't have it written down. I mean, it's just like a low mode. I don't have it written down here. We only tried one initial condition. So, I mean, obviously we can do more than that.
Well, what was the initial condition? Was it the ISO 150 contradiction?
No. It was cosine 3x sine y. Something. I mean, it was just like the lowest mode that possibly could fit. Right. And it just went.
So that's like a Taylor-Green initial condition.
Yeah, very much like the Taylor Green initial. Kida came up with it. So what I wanted to try to do, and then you turn to filaments. You know, there's a lot of caveats with vortex filaments, but let's give it a try, see what you get. And so I wanted to get something that looked like that in the near field, and just did something in the far field. So here's the initial condition that I came up with for the filament, the Bias of R calculation. So these are actually elastica, solutions of elastic beam. So they have this sort of dipole structure out here, and then the curvature just gets small enough out there that it's harmless. So these are basically six rings, elliptical rings kind of shot at each other. Okay? And don't worry about this one. It's just another initial condition that I tried. I had the movie, but I thought I would be fancy and do it with the computer, but the software isn't here. So, anyway, this is a little bit time later. It starts kind of forming a longer dipole and coming in. This is a close up of it. A little bit later, it does. It gets a little closer. Like this, and you start seeing a kind of structure here. This is actually the core radius, and I neck down the cores according to the axial strain.
Is
okay.
Which is Gauss-Biot?
No, this is Bias of R.
All right. Bias of R.
And then finally, if you just analyze the inside, you get something like this. So a little bit later. And if you blow it up, say 100 times, 132 times, it looks like this. You wait a little bit later and blow it up 10,000 times, it looks like that. And so this thing is actually collapsing in a self-similar way. Okay, now, again, it's a filament, but within this filament model, there appears to be this inner collapse, this self-similar collapse. And, I mean, one good thing about BSOR is it's, you can get, here's the magnification versus time. And you estimate critical time from the data, and so here are different initial conditions. And you can just bang, I mean, this is a day on a workstation. You can get 10 decades of exact scaling. The length scale, basically what this means is that the length scale, which is 1 over the magnification, goes as the square root of time. Okay, so this thing, the closest, this dipole structure, if you look at the closeness to the origin, that length scale goes as the secret minus c, to the 1/2 power. So this thing is closing in on itself, and at least for the filaments, it's fairly well established here. Okay, so that was encouraging. Here's vorticity. It converges a little bit more slowly, but the vorticity blows as 1/time. And also I should say, these are different initial conditions, so it's apparently an attracting solution. But within this symmetric space, I'm supporting these symmetries. Okay, so, you know, there's lots of other information. I can give you some references on that if anyone cares. But now you start looking, try to find the reason why this is happening. And so you have to, if you look at the vorticity equation, right? I mean, there's a lot. Well, you know what it is. The strain rate and times the vorticity is the substantial derivative of vorticity. This has, basically, you want this to go as vorticity, and then you have a 1/time blow up of vorticity. So the strain rate is extremely important, and it actually has to blow up too. Actually, Constantin defines it. He calls this a quantity alpha, but it's the axial stretching. And you can show, for instance, the magnitude of vorticity of this axial stretching. And this axial stretching term has a very nice form. You just take the BSOR law and you differentiate it and play some games. I don't want to define it. It's very messy. But this is the key. You have to get, effectively what you have to get is this axial stretching, the axial strain rate, to be a function of the vorticity. Okay, that's the name of the game. Now, if you take all the candidate blow-ups that people have considered, they all happen. I mean, Bob Kerr's and this Grauer's new one. Everybody has the blow-up on a symmetry plane, a reflectional symmetry plane. So I want to start narrowing down my space, and this is the first thing I want to do. I want to assume a tube coming out of a reflectional symmetry plane, okay, and it'll be x1 equals 0. Now, this is a really nice place to look because the vorticity is normal, and then the principal axis of the strain rate matrix is always normal also. So you always have the alignment of the strain rate and the vorticity, okay? And if you look at the vorticity that has to blow up in that plane, it just looks like that. So looking at just this guy on the plane and seeing its behavior is key. And now you can take that nasty integral and you can write it now. And now you actually see the problem. It becomes fairly apparent. The strain rate on the plane looks like this, the principal value, integral over all space, omega 3 and omega 2. But we want omega 1 to blow up. So Obviously, this has to be a function of curvature. And in fact, if you make this expansion, plug it back in, you can bring omega 1 back in, but this becomes a non-singular integral then. And so what has to in fact happen is that the curvature has to blow up on the plane in order for the strain rate to blow up, in order for the vorticity to blow up. So you have this thing that, you know, Constantine's theorem says that the direction field of the vorticity has to become, what is it, not coherent, I think he called it. But basically what has to happen is that the curvature of the vortex line has to blow up. So, in fact, this thing has to kink as it's coming off the plane. So you get this tube, has to kink in order for it to blow up, or for vorticity to blow up there. Strange. Okay, and in fact, the dipolar collapse scenario, has another reflectional symmetry plane, but it's the same thing holds. You have to have this tube's kinking on the plane. All right, so what's the idea then? So curvature, so you have a filament or a tube, the vortex line coming out of the plane. Here's the dynamical equation. Let's define the curvatures in the plane here. So you can have the, you know, curvature in the two direction, curvature in the three direction. Okay? And you can write down the dynamical equation for the curvature in the plane. And so what you find is this. Kind of messy. But basically, what you find is that there's a negative influence of the out-of-plane strain. You can see this. And there's a tube multiplying it. So this is a rather annoying thing. And it leads you to a contradiction. In order to have large strain, you have to have large curvature. But having large strain lowers curvature. And so I just cannot see how one can a vortex can self-stretch itself. Yes, you know, stretch itself. So you know, you can say, well, what about this term? This is actually the curvature of the streamlines.
But you have two vortices. You left one out by symmetry.
Yeah, but it's still, yeah, it's okay. It doesn't. You mean just the one, the other part of it?
The one that's on the other side of the symmetry axis, in some sense.
The dipole or the
dipole.
It doesn't really matter. It's a subtle point, but the fact that you have this image from a reflectional symmetry doesn't change the fact that the curvature has to blow up. So that's, so we can talk about it. It's a rather subtle thing, but that's the point. So frankly, I don't see how we can you can get enough strain rate here. You know, when the strain rate gets big, let's say you have a lot of curvature, and that gives you a large strain rate, well, that would tend to decrease the curvature. So let's go back to the symmetries that I've been using in the simulations. So this cubic symmetry, okay? And so all three of the zero planes are a mirror, so the fundamental is the octant. And then the rotational symmetry is you take this octant and you divide it into three parts. And so you have a rotational symmetry here. And so here's the fundamental domain. You can write it in spherical coordinates or Cartesian coordinates. And so if you assume a flow that has all these symmetries, some nice things happen. Here's a little picture maybe of the non-orthogonal grid that I've been using. You go back to that strain rate integral, and remember what it was before. Before you only had an omega 2 and omega 3, but because you have that rotational symmetry that in fact acts like a permutation on the indices of the vorticity, you get omega 1 popping up in there, multiplied by a smooth kernel. So with the symmetries, if you have a flow that has all these symmetries, you get in the strain rate integral, you get omega 1 popping up, which is what we want. All right. Okay.
Wait, is that S11, U11?
Yes, that's U11. So it's like the out-of-plane strain. So now you have a tube here. Now, if you have all these symmetries, all these images, now you have something that, in fact, is a function of your own strength. Okay. But the problem is it's not singular anymore. It's smooth, this kernel. But it looks good. Here are isosurfaces of this kernel, assuming that this X bar is here. So you can imagine a tube cutting through this thing and picking up integral way, picking up thing. And it's all positive, too. So there is, with these images, you can actually get a strain rate proportional to the vorticity. It's independent of curvature.
So this is coming from the neighboring vortices.
Exactly.
From the
right.
Yeah.
Right. So this geometric setup allows you to have lots of strain rate. Okay. So that's key. So you have that, and in fact, you can go back to those pseudospectral simulations.
Doesn't the curvature increase anyway? Just because
it will, but it's not. It will, but
it's goes the length.
It turns out it does, but it's actually a fairly weak function. There are strain rate does come from the curvature, but the bulk of it comes from these images. It's kind of secondary in this. So if you go back to that isosurface plot that I had before and just extract the vortex in the fundamental domain, you have the vorticity here. But if you multiply it by this kernel, you can see there's a very large correlation here. And so you do, I guess what I'm saying is that there's these images really allow you to pick up things. Yeah, I should maybe skip this, but this is the strain, this is the strain budget. So here's the vortex in the plane, the out-of-plane strain rate, and this is what's due to the fundamental and reflected images, and these are due to the rotational images. So this is the new part that comes. And you can see that there's a significant new strain rate that's there. So that's a bit messy, unfortunately. So that's all well and good. But you have these images that are straining the tube coming out of the reflectional symmetry plane. But if they don't come together, then you're not going to get an increase in anything. You need a collapse. Yeah.
So the discussion is for the dominant model?
For any of them.
Where you just...
It's independent.
Language.
Yeah, okay. It's independent of what model, numerical model. I just did a simple filament model, and you can show you're picking up a lot of strain rate this way. So it's not a big deal. So the question is, do we have a nice velocity field that will aid in the collapse? Does this thing actually collapse? Is the velocity right? And if you think about these symmetries, it's really quite pretty. The reflectional symmetry planes, first of all, the origin is a critical point. The velocity is zero at the origin, okay? But because these planes are reflectional, it means that these guys are the manifolds, the outgoing and incoming manifolds. Okay? So they're the incoming streamlines and the outgoing streamlines. And it's fairly easy to convince yourself that because of reflectional symmetries you have that. Okay? Now, incompressibility causes the sum of these guys to be zero, so you have to have, you know, either two incoming or one and one outgoing or whatever. They have to add up to zero. But with this rotational symmetry, what happens is it causes each one of these to be either outgoing or incoming. They have to be the same. So what does that mean? The critical point is degenerate. And so the first order terms go away, and you're actually left only with third order terms. So it's very, it's actually critical to have a degenerate a critical point at the origin where you're collapsing. So all of these guys and all the axes can be incoming manifolds. Okay? And if the diagonals are the axes are incoming manifolds, the diagonals are outgoing manifolds. And so you have these six incoming manifolds, incoming streamlines, and the outgoing streamline is along the diagonal. Okay? So that's a very nice thing of the symmetries. And jumping ahead of myself, maybe I won't. Well, I'll just put it up. If you do the filament model with a local induction, and you look at the way that the filament is coming in towards the origin, there's a radial velocity and an angular velocity, and you expand in curvature, the leading order term always has a negative velocity, and then the corrections sometimes add positive, but that's not a big deal. The velocity goes as 1 over L, and L is the distance to the origin, so this thing is collapsing. The more important one is the angular velocity. There is actually a zero point, and it's a stable point. And so what you have is a filament coming out of this plane that there's a certain angle in which it will come and accelerate in toward the origin. So that's... and it's all due to these symmetries, which is very nice. Yeah?
In your filament model, what do you do with the radius of the filament?
Oh, yeah, that's, near the endpoints of a segment, you know, and the next time they go to this, you have a certain radius. You neck the radius down.
You maintain volume.
Yeah. It's a standard thing that people
circulation
do.
Is conserved.
Yeah. Right. And that's actually very important. I mean, this has to happen. This is a length scale, and you have to have enough axial strain rate to keep this thing necking down. So it's very, very important. So, so that's as far as I've taken this analysis. But the upshot is that if you confine yourself to this cubic symmetry space, you can see these images stretching themselves and allowing a collapse. So that's important. So let me just switch gears, and let's assume if there is a collapse, a self-similar collapse, then you could do a scale transformation and look for steady solutions, right? And so Larrey thought of this, back in 1934. Let's assume that you have a blow up at a certain point, moving at a certain velocity at a time t0. You can transform into a spherically collapsing wave domain, and you come out with something fairly benign here. So this is the transformed Euler equations in this collapsed frame, and what you want to find is where this is zero. Okay. Alpha is the strength of the velocity as it blows, as the thing collapses. It's the amplification of the velocity.
Is that Larrey's equation?
Well, Larrey didn't do this Luray did Navier-Stokes, and with Navier-Stokes, the viscous term actually sets out to be one half. And so that is, okay. So now, all of these things, people say, oh, self-similarity, self-similarity, but in fact, you're never, it, there are many reasons why you're not going to have full self-similarity. Okay. The idea is that you're going to get self-similarity in the limit as you go to the critical time. And it's kind of like an inner solution. Okay, so, you know, everybody does these simulations, you know, you have the, and then all of a sudden in this little area you get this collapse, right? So everybody's really dealing with an asymptotic, like an inner, a region that has a collapse. You're not dealing with a full global self-similarity. Okay? So that's important. Okay, that's one point that I want to make. Another point is that if this is going to happen, you're going to have to lose, it has to be a universal collapse, and so it has to be independent in the sense of initial conditions. Yeah.
Why can't it be continued outward as in a self-similar way? Since you know, it's not that this lack of similarity is important because you have some non-local interactions and you want some lower symmetry for the out, right?
Yeah. Well, there are energy considerations. Let's say, you know, in these filament simulations, you saw that simply the vortices actually go out radially. So if these things want to continue out into the far field, you'd have infinite energy, right? So that, and also there have been some work, Navier-Stokes doesn't have global self-similarity. There's a guy, Nikas, I can give you the reference. Have some check work.
But again, assuming some finite energy.
Yes.
But wouldn't it be interesting to have a self-similar solution even with infinite energy?
Well, there have been some constructed flows. I mean,
but then if it gives you the correct local structure, that's a useful solution.
Yeah. But on its own, you can't.
See, before you said that the distant images were important, but now the distant images
are
not.
No, they are. Well, they're not that distant. I mean, this thing is collapsing, so all the images are getting closer to it.
When you say images, that's what you meant, the large scale things. You don't mean the large scale, you mean
no,
the mirror images.
Just the mirror images. Oh. Right, yeah. And so, let me continue. So, what if you have some sort of inner solution or asymptotic approach to self-similarity, you have to somehow lose your initial conditions. And also, you know, this is a Hamiltonian system. How can you have an attracting solution in a Hamiltonian system? Well, it turns out, you know, that the transformation that I had on the last slide is not volume preserving, so that's not a big deal. But one of the main things is, you know, you want energy conservation. And so you define it as the kinetic energy within a ball. And then if you use that transformation, you find that in the collapse frame, it looks like this. Well, if it's going to be constant, that really nails down the alpha in a global sense. So global self-similarity has to have alpha equal to 3/5, right? And Constantine showed that in Plumeau and various people. But actually, it's a subtle thing. If you allow local, you don't have to have the ball going to infinity. You know, you can actually take T to T zero and have this finite, and this thing still blows up. And so really, what I'm trying to say is that in an asymptotic sense, if you only look for self-similarity in an asymptotic sense, conservation of energy is not useful. You can't do anything. It's ambiguous. You can have anything. A more useful conservation quantity is circulation, and that nails, if you want conservation of circulation, alpha has to be a half. And that's what we're finding in our simulations.
Let me just ask you a quick question. What do you mean by the information on initial conditions must be locked in the power system?
You have to go to this steady solution, right? What you're doing in the limit is going to this solution, independent of initial conditions. So all transients have to die away, right?
So transients. Is that another way of saying that solution has to have some kind of a basin of attraction associated with it?
Yeah. So it has to be independent of initial conditions.
Why can't one contemplate solutions which depend on locked out, the periodic and locked out?
A periodic and locked out.
So they still collapse.
Yeah.
But they wiggle periodically.
Right? How do you get periodicity with a log or periodicity?
No, just periodic function of locked out.
Oh, periodic function of locked out.
So they make even a number of widows before they collapse. Mm-hmm. Right. They have all the same scaling properties. It's a much wider class of solution.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
in fact, these are the kind of solutions that Amir and Sujit were advocating.
Okay. That's a class that we haven't considered.
On the basis of their numerics? Did they see oscillations in their numerics?
What they see is, first of all, blow up not at the symmetry point, but off symmetry point.
Which one is there? Boussinet?
Yeah.
But
also like the symmetric thing.
The
swirl.
Same.
I think it was the same scenario. So yeah. they see growth of vorticity, so on so the shoulder of the parabola, and that grows for a while. And then it sort of peters out, and then there's another instability arising on the shoulder. And
their work was brought into question by the Their work has been brought into question.
I think it's been really proven that they don't have
question, right?
No. I think if you take the historical trend, there was no rebuttal to the work being brought into question. There were.
Right. There were some more.
But, I think this came up in connection with here.
Whether they were wrong or right.
To any question, right? One can consider a broader class of solutions.
Right. That we're not. Yeah. It's a dangerous game, you know.
I thought that their work was shown to be wrong because of the assumption of because the vortex became flatter instead of staying circular as they assumed.
Right. 2D Boussinet.
That was, as I recall, it was shown by themselves, and this was the issue with the Stillman's approximation.
Yeah.
Right. And this goes back to 81.
Yeah.
And they've been working on this for another 10 years, so there are other things.
By the way, you can also ask another question. What would happen if you had two vortex filaments that weren't the same?
Hmm.
And then I think you could get an oscillatory solution. Right. But I think with the same circulation in the vortex filament, I think there's too much symmetry. So I think if you relax the circulation.
So this is exactly the path that they took. You know, they started looking at the filaments, then they realized that the filaments were flattened, and you cannot study instability in the filaments. Then they realized that they could not get enough curvature in the symmetry point, and they started looking at these asymmetric solutions. And then they started finding that if you look at the asymmetric solutions, you start picking up this log tau dependence. So, I'm not involved in that, right?
Yeah.
So I'm just giving you an outsider's view. But so they just basically went in the direction of lower symmetry.
Yeah. One of the reasons why the filament gave a misleading result is the core is in fact here's one filament in the dipole, here's the other. The cores overlap across the symmetry plane, and that's a no-no. You lose Helmholtz And so it became a non-Euler model once the cores start overlapping themselves. So
it's called numerical regularization.
Okay, so let's assume that we have one of these steady collapse solutions, okay? Not the way that Boris says is oscillatory. Let's just say we have this steady solution of the transformed equation. You do a perturbation, and it's fairly easy to see that there's a separation that looks like this. Q is an eigenvalue. And then the one perturbation equation looks like this. Okay? Let me go back. If I may go back to this original equation here for a minute. Let's say alpha is 1/2, okay, so you get rid of this term. What you have is here's the v cross omega, effectively the v cross omega term, right? You have an extra velocity in there. It's a function of the distance to the origin. Okay, it's like a breeze from the origin. You're making this transformation into an accelerating frame, and so this is the breeze, this is the opposite breeze that you're getting from the origin, right? And that's really all the difference is, assuming that alpha is 1/2. Okay? So at a certain point, say in the wake outside, where the radial distance is much greater than the velocity, you can actually say that term is greater than this. Okay, so outside the sort of collapsed region in the wake, you can have that. And so the perturbation equation simplifies to this, which has an analytic solution. Okay? And it looks like this. And so the upshot is that when alpha is between 0 and 1, modes with q greater than 0 grow. And so if you want like the Taylor series expansion about the origin, that would be n negative. If n is negative, q is negative, and so all Taylor series expansions about the origin decay. And so in unscaled coordinates, it's even nicer. But the bottom line is that in this wake region, outside this collapse, all information that had the form of a Taylor series about the origin, those modes decay. And so this goes into our feeling that you actually can have a loss of information in the initial conditions in this frame. It's a bit of a lot of logic there, unfortunately. And then finally, if you ask, you can also do, without knowing the solution, you can do a little bit more. You can assume another transformation and basically assume that these new places where the singular point is, the velocity, the critical time, are small departures from the one that you had. And then you can eliminate things and you can look at the difference, the new solution, how the new solution behaves based on the old solution. You can do a Taylor series expansion. And you can get ideas like if you make a mistake, if you perturb the critical time, you find that the modes are unstable, the new solution is unstable, and here's the eigenvector. If you miss and perturb the point of collapse, it's still unstable, and here's the eigenvector. This is a simple scaling parameter. It's neutrally stable. It shouldn't have anything to do. And then if you miss by a Galilean boost, in fact, it's stable because of the Galilean invariance. And here's the eigenvalue. So even though you don't have the solution, you can do some analysis, assuming that you do have this collapsed solution. Things look reasonable. All right, so I'll just sum up. So here, this is some work Flows of cubic symmetry seem to be a possibility here. We get numerical evidence, and it looks like self-similar class. The origin is degenerate critical point. I think there's a preprint around from Constantine that says that if there is going to be a blow-up, it has to be at a degenerate critical point. If anybody has that, let me know. I can't seem to find it. The axial stretching, I didn't go through this very much, but the axial stretching by the images increases as the distance to the origin, to the minus 2. The velocity, in fact, goes like this, so it's an acceleration towards the origin. The notions of asymptotic self-similarity and renormalization of the equations. The inner solution appears to be attracting from the analysis we've done on this. And you can also get the sort of obvious results that if you miss the critical time, your velocity, you're unstable. If you miss the critical time and the critical point. So not a proof yet, but we're getting a little bit closer. So that's all I want to say.
So I just want to ask you a question. I mean, you don't have to have that high symmetry to get collapse.
Right? Well, what do you mean by collapse?
Well, I mean, what you showed was evidence that omega is going like 1 over t.
Yeah.
Why do you get that without any kind of symmetry?
Right.
You don't have to have a lot of symmetry to get that.
Yeah, but
in other words, what I'm saying is there's something very generic about this domain, and perhaps we're not looking at it the right way.
Well, just because you get 1 over t, evidence of 1 over t blow-up, doesn't mean that you have a solution that actually ends in a singularity in real time. I just plot here the difference between 1 over z, this is just the real coordinate. So you have a function 1 over z versus a function z over z squared plus epsilon squared. So the singularities are out at plus or minus epsilon, I epsilon. Okay? And the fact is that as you're coming in towards the origin, think of the critical time here and time going this way, you get exactly the right asymptotic until you get to a ball that's equal to the epsilon. And so, you know, you can be completely fooled.
No,
but the singularity could be an imaginary time.
Evidence for singularity based
yeah.
on 1 over t. I mean, I realize that. I mean,
yeah.
There's also one very critical point that is, you don't have to show that graph. All you have to do is say that when your two vortices come together to be the regularization distance, then it saturates. That's physical. As soon as the two vortices on the other side of the plane, there has to be a regularization radius in the Biot-Savart law, otherwise it's singular.
Yeah.
So everybody who's ever done this calculation has a small scale size. Okay.
Right.
And as soon as they overlap, that's what you see.
Okay. I thought the hope was that they'll get stretched faster than they move together. So
yeah.
That they will not
see,
overlap, right?
You need an axial strain, right? You need this happening. You need the axial strain to go as the vorticity.
So they're getting thinner.
Yeah, what I'm saying is if they don't do
that, then you don't have finite singularity. But the hope was to prove that they're thinning out faster than they're moving for the same rate as they're moving together, so you have a similarity solution.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
If you don't have it, well,
yeah, I'm just arguing on one level.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to make one very important point. That you didn't bring up, which we studied. And that is, since this is a Hamiltonian system, energy is conserved. Now, for a filamentary system, you can write down the energy as a double integral along the contour. So therefore, if you look at it as a single integral, then that everywhere along the contour there is an energy density.
Yep.
Now, the question is, if I asked you to make up a guess as to what the energy density is when these things are approaching collapse, what would you say? You probably argue as a physicist right off the top of your head that the energy density is going down,
Go up, but the
volume. In fact, that's just what it does. If you plot the energy density in any reconnection event, any collapse event, and nobody seems to have argued the energy point of view, you will find that the energy density along the single filament is a minimum. Therefore, when you're going into collapse, the energy density is a minimum. That's a fact. Okay? What you do with that fact, I'm not sure. But it certainly makes a lot of physical sense, because reconnection will not involve a lot of energy. That's what it says.
But what I was trying to show here is that I don't think that the singularity can happen with straight reconnection, the reconnection scenario. You have to get your tubes to kink. And I don't see how, they want to flatten. And if there's a large strain, they'll be pulled out. They'll be large, the curvature's going to go down. In order for the strain to blow up, which has to happen, you got to have a kinking, and I don't see it ever happening. And so, you can't rely on your self-destruct.
But I ask you, what is the curvature at that point? Isn't it growing?
Not after they start flattening. Right? All the reconnection cases.
You don't see flattening with your BO sub, right? You see it with the the continuum code.
I don't see flattening. You mean in the cubic symmetry?
No, you mentioned BO sub and local induction boxes too. So do you see flattening with those?
There's a slight flattening, but not much. The fact is that these things are bathed in a strain rate that keeps the cores necking down, and everything is comes into the origin self-similarly. So you don't have much of a flattening of the cores. And that key. See, that bath of strain rate is not there if you don't have this cubic symmetry. So just ramming two vortices together just flattens it, and that's it. And you're done. And I don't, I just can't see it happening without this extra boost of strain rate.
In Bob Kuhn's original Nandi-Sweet calculation, he had this elbow structure.
I don't understand that. The more I look at it, the more confused I get by it. It doesn't seem to be physical. I can't explain it.
If that's what you say, then that means there's something wrong, or what?
Well, I don't want to say that something is wrong. This analyticity strip analysis, he starts with a non-analytic, a completely algebraic initial condition, so he has no analyticity strip from the beginning. So this is maybe a big red flag. It just is there. That evidence is there. It doesn't seem to be going anywhere. I can't see it in the meager analysis that I've done that it should happen, that singularity should happen.
I'd like to make another comment from a test particle point of view. Okay, supposing I took your dominant vortices, and around it I put in a whole array of test vortices. Okay, what do I mean by that? That is, you can make it as symmetrical as you want, just as a Gedanken problem. And each one of those vortices, of course not overlapping with the original one, has as infinitesimal a circulation as you would like, okay?
Yeah.
And then you let that system collapse. What is going to happen to that? The thing is, one of the things we would like is whenever we do a problem, it's robust to a certain kind of small perturbation.
So the stability of it.
Yes, right, exactly, right. And I would say that would be a very different solution.
Yeah.
Because all those little ones will eventually be strained up to be of the same vorticity.
Well, it depends on whether you're still in the symmetric space or not. At least in the filament, you can do quite a bit to this if you're still maintaining symmetries, and it'll still collapse the same way. I've done some studies on that. So I'm not saying it's stable to symmetry breaking perturbations, but I think it's there is a reasonable basin of attraction in the symmetric.
Going back to more generic configurations. So, right, so there is some amplification of vorticity and then the geometric completion and
The depletion is basically this omega 2 and omega 3 coming.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah,
but wouldn't it be interesting? Right, okay, but so there is no finite time singularity, sorry, but it is a generic process. And vorticity is amplified.
Yeah.
So from the point of view of hydrodynamics, it would be interesting, perhaps, to know how much it's amplified before it is speeded up. Is there some way of parameterizing the, this partial blow up?
Right, sort of a...
parameterizing this amplification process in some way.
Right.
One could, I give you some initial condition and you calculate some normal modes and tell me how much vorticity you will amplify before going up.
Well, you're asking me to
ask the question. You can search data sets for that. For configurations. You can say, okay, I give you a data set like Xi Chen's data set, and I say, what fraction of space is covered by collapsed configurations?
Well, yeah, that's done, but this is...
Dresselhaus and Tabor.
This has no dynamics. It is looking for warmth. Whereas, I'm trying to... what's being done here is one studies the dynamics. And I'm trying to ask a dynamical question. Given the piece of velocity configuration, which doesn't have high vorticity, can you tell me if it's going to develop vorticity in some near future and how much?
Yeah. What in a sense, it can be characterized by a singularity in complex space time.
Yeah.
How far is that away in a sense? I mean, it's a nice thought. I don't know if one can do that. But Dresselhaus's thesis, he was a student of Tabor's, tried to do something like that. And basically, you have a tube that has an alpha alignment with some strain field. It gets strong enough so that it becomes beta because of its own induced strain perpendicular. Some scenario like that. So, yeah. But that's all sort of exponential. I mean, it's an outside strain rate.
Yeah.
So I don't think it really has much to do with the finite time scenario. Yeah?
The scale, asymptotic scale transformation by the conservation of circulation, the parameter alpha, running as 1 over 2.
Right.
And by that value, the energy.
Right, it does, yeah, sure. Uh-huh.
And what kind of singularity is it? Singularity of curvature of, I wonder what kind of singularity it is.
Right, the energy in this in the ball goes to zero. Right. That's what we see. It's allowed, right? Energy would be conserved. What do you mean? What kind of singularity? I see. Well, the velocity blows up, right?
No. Vanishes.
No, the velocity blows up.
Blows up.
Yeah, as 1 over square root of time.
Energy
goes to zero. Yeah. So it's like it's harmless in a sense. In what I see is that you have this region, and then you have this collapse. The matching region to the outer flow is radial vortex lines. It comes down, collapses, and then and it's really isolated from the outer flow. Okay, so you have this. It could go off without anybody noticing. It's just rather a wimpy singularity, I'm afraid.
You said vortex collapse is a wimpy singularity.
Yeah.
Whatever you said?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
It's
a low energy, not very strong.
Yeah, not anything to. It's not worth $1 million. As far as.
Could be where you dissipate turbulence.
It won't dissipate turbulence, no. That's the annoying thing. You can't get energy dissipation in the Euler system like this.
Now, by the way, I didn't realize that, but what you just said. That's consistent with what I said we observed. Computationally, we observed zero energy density.
Anyway, any comments would be helpful.
Thank you very much.